You're listening to an event from the U.S. Institute of Peace, part of the USIP podcast network. For more information about our work around the world, visit usip.org and check us out on social media.
Thank you all. Welcome back. I'm delighted to welcome you at this time to welcome the distinguished members of our panel on harnessing economics and trade, which will be moderated by the Honorable Ambassador Carla Sands. Ambassador Sands has enjoyed a successful career in business, in government, and in philanthropy. She's served on the boards of Pepperdine University, the Los Angeles Museum of Contemporary Art, and the Los Angeles Philharmonic. She served as U.S. Ambassador to Denmark from 2017 to 2021. She's the former chair and CEO of Vintage Capital Group, and she is currently vice chair of the Center for Energy and Environment at the America First Policy Institute. Ambassador Sands and distinguished panelists, may I invite you to the stage.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. It's my pleasure to welcome you to this important panel discussion on harnessing economics and trade. In the rapidly evolving global landscape, the intersection of economics, trade, and national security have never been more critical. And I'll just say, and diplomacy too, for those of you in the DIP Corps. Today, we'll explore the global economic challenges facing the United States and how the Trump administration is likely to tackle them. And to guide us through these issues, we're joined by two distinguished experts, Matt Goodman, the Senior Vice President at the Council for Foreign Relations, whose deep expertise in international trade and economic policy has informed some of the most pivotal conversations on global strategy, and Josh Lipsky, Senior Director at the Atlantic Council's Geoeconomics Center, who brings unparalleled insights into global financial markets and the nexus of economics and national security.
Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thanks for having us.
So thank you for joining us today. We want to start with a broad question to set the stage. Josh and Matt, how do you anticipate U.S. foreign economic policy evolving between the Biden and Trump administrations? Where do you expect to see continuity, and where do you think we'll see the most change? And after that, we'll dive deeper into specific topics, beginning with tariffs. Josh, why don't we start with you?
Well, thank you, Ambassador, and thank you so much to USIP for having us and for this entire day. It's such an important event and really honored to be a part of it. I think many people will be surprised about how much continuity there is, specifically in the realm of what we describe as geoeconomics, economic statecraft, by which we mean the intersection of national security, finance, and economics. And the reason I believe that is that these trends go beyond party affiliation, and they've really been developing for the past decade, at the end of the Obama administration, the first Trump administration, and certainly through the Biden administration. And there's been a realization across Washington, across Republican and Democratic policymaking circles, that we in the US have to better fuse our national security and economic policymaking. You just heard the fantastic conversation with the Admiral speaking so much about economic security, ports, China, Belt and Road. That's just a microcosm of what Washington has realized over the past decade. And what I always say about this issue is that this is not a new idea. This is an old idea. This is what the founding of the Bretton Woods system was all about. The Bretton Woods Conference happened 6 weeks after D-Day, in the middle of World War II, not after World War II. We created the IMF and the World Bank. But we in the US really, post the fall of the Soviet Union, had the luxury of separating out, in large part, not solely, but in large part, our economic and our national security policy making. We could let the global economy and trade and globalization develop, and we didn't need to think in the economic circles where I came from at the IMF as much about what the Pentagon was doing. That was not something that was front and center at the IMF. But that changed. It changed for a variety of reasons, and we can go into. But the bottom line is we in the US realize we have to approach these issues differently. And go to China, go to India, ask them how they fuse economic and national security policymaking. It would be strange to even ask them that question because they do it every day. So we are rediscovering what this means in the West. And I think the end result is you actually see more bipartisan consensus on these issues, even if the tools deployed look very different in a Democratic or Republican administration.
Matt?
Thank you, and thanks again to USIP. Really honored to be here. Terrific event. I agree with Josh, as often we do. We're going to try to find some areas where we disagree, but I do agree that it's easy to focus on the change, and there will be change, particularly in obviously personnel, tone, areas of focus, and one area of substance that I'll come back to. But I just want to underscore the continuity point. Both the points that Josh made, that this is a longer term trend. I mean, I could even go further back. You could say, you know, the Barbary Pirates or something. Yeah. Economics and national security have been interwoven for a long time, so it's not new. When I worked for Steve Hadley at the NSC, you know, my boss working on economic issues was part of the NSC, and it was, you know, integrated in that sense as well. But I do think there is this change now where it's much more central, and there is, I think, a bipartisan consensus on a lot of things, you know, for good and bad. Some of it, I think, is worrisome trends about what we agree on. I think when you look at, I sometimes describe sort of this new area of economic security, which obviously means something different to ordinary Americans, is putting food on the table and having a job. But here in Washington, it's sort of this nexus of economics and national security as a kind of spectrum. And in the middle, there is definitely risk or heightened risk, whether that risk is from pandemics or climate change or China. And I think it's natural that government wants to intervene in there, in that space. But at the margins of that term, like at the economic end of economic security, you know, we want to be careful not to slip into protectionism and use this sort of problem as an excuse for protectionism. And at the other end, at the security end, you don't want this to become an excuse for weaponizing everything commercial that may have a theoretical risk. So I think there's a lot, and that's easy to say, and then defining exactly what we should be doing in that space is the hard part. But I think there is broad bipartisan consensus about that, and so I do expect a lot of continuity. The one thing other than the obvious things about the tools and the tone and all the rest that I sometimes say, and it may not be helpful to you, but it's the way I think about it. I think relatively speaking, the Biden administration was a little less focused on trade and a little more focused on technology. Mm-hmm. And I think that may reverse in a Trump administration where there's going to be more focus on trade because that's what the president really cares about. And technology will continue. There's continuity on both of those issues. Like the Biden people kept the tariffs in place, but it was a pretty passive trade policy in the Biden administration. It's going to be much more active this time. On technology, there will be continued technology controls and focus on those issues, but I think relatively speaking, I'm looking for a little bit of adjustment between those two sort of broad sets of issues.
Thank you. So Josh, there was a lot of talk about tariffs during the campaign. How do you see American trade policy and tariffs coming forward in 2021 compared to back in 2017?
Well, it only took us 5 minutes to get to tariffs, which feels appropriate given what I think is going to happen less than a week from now after the inauguration and the executive orders. But I think it's worth considering if we were having this event 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, we would not be talking about tariffs with an incoming administration. So it's worth just pausing for a moment to think how far the policy debate has changed. And that is in large part because of the president-elect, the incoming president's policy priorities. And I agree with Matt, and it's important to understand this is a core policy conviction of this president, formed not in the 2000s, not in the 1990s, but really in the 1980s with competition between the US and Japan, as Matt knows so well. And this is where his views about bilateral trade deficits stem from, what tariffs can or can't do. And so it's deeply rooted. And the bottom line is there are going to be tariffs. They will not look exactly like they were promised in the campaign. I do believe that. So we will not see on day one, I don't think, 60% tariffs on Chinese imports. The destabilizing effect on that in the global economy would be massive. And that's already why you see reports in the press over the last few days about the idea of gradually increasing tariffs. You will not see 20% across the board tariffs on all other imports. So there will be tariffs, but they will look different. I think they will be more tailored. I do not think they will be as blanket and sweeping as we've heard in the campaign. When you think about Trump and tariffs, I think it's important to think about three buckets of tariffs. First are tariffs as a negotiating tool. This is what we saw with Canada, Mexico, the 25% threat. It's a threat meant to be part of a negotiation. We're in the USMCA renegotiation period now going into 2026. That's one type of tariff process you see with Trump. The second is tariff, meant to actually be a tariff and produce more manufacturing or other products grown here in the United States and help support jobs, the pure use of a tariff. The third, and this is new this time around, this is different than the first Trump administration, is tariffs as punishment. And you saw this a little about his de-dollarization tweet, and we'll get into this. Countries who are de-dollarizing, there was a threat of tariffs. I do believe this incoming Trump administration is moving away from financial sanctions, which they see as very binary. You turn them off or you turn them on, versus tariffs as a tool of punishment, which can be calibrated 5, 10, 15%. Ratcheted up or ratcheted down. And so that's a bit of a wrinkle this time that we didn't see last time, and that's overall how I see the tariff picture.
Thanks a lot. So Matt, you know, in this incoming administration, how do you see the trade disputes, for instance, with the EU and Canada? How do you see that unfolding?
Yeah, well, again, I agree with Josh, but I think here's one area where we may have a slight disagreement. We'll see in a week who's right, but I don't expect 60% tariffs on day one, but I think the interesting divergence or the thing we should be watching on January 20th or 1st, 21st, is does the president pursue kind of the narrower, broad as they are, authorities like Section 301, which deals with unfair trade practices, Section 232, which is the national security provision on trade. Does he kind of go down that route, which is a bit of a softer approach because it requires time to get public comment and implement and create exemptions and so forth? Or does he deploy the kind of nuclear weapon of international economic policy, yeah, which is IEEPA, the International Economic Emergency Powers Act, and if you haven't been able to roll that off your tongue the way I just did, you better start practicing because it's going to be a term you're going to hear about. This law that was passed by Congress in the Carter administration, allowing the president to declare an international economic emergency, and then he can do whatever he wants, basically. He has a lot of authority to do a lot of things. And if he does that on day one, then I think brace yourself because he could do quite a bit from the beginning. I mean, overall, on both of those paths, it turns out the president has a lot of authority to raise tariffs. I think we all thought this was Congress's job, but it turns out the executive has a lot of power through those delegations and other things. And there was one other thing that Josh said that I wanted to just foot stomp and agree with, but I can't remember what it is, so why don't we carry on?
Well, let's talk about industrial policy, yeah. Josh. It's looked at as a cornerstone for U.S. efforts to enhance our competitiveness, protect our national security, particularly critical things like semiconductors, rare earth minerals, our defense.
Certainly.
How do you see that industrial policy evolving under the Trump administration?
Yeah, and let me just say one more thing on tariffs, and this is where Matt and I might have disagreement.
We could just,
but this is what Washington wants to talk about, and fairly, because it's important. It's going to affect everyone's lives, both here in the U.S. and around the world, so it's an important topic. One other dimension which I think might hold back the Trump administration is inflation. 2017, 2018, inflation was not on the policy agenda. Now it is one of the reasons he is back in the Oval Office. So the political impact of inflation, how salient that is to people, and if there is a tie-in between some of the tariffs and inflation, I think that could be restrictive. Now, the economists coming into the Trump administration will say the tariffs are not inflationary. We can debate this all day, price levels, price change, but it's important to understand that this is different than 2017, 2018, and it will be a dynamic.
And can I just say to that, I think that's a very important point. And I think if there is a constraint on the president, it's going to be that, or the stock market, I guess, would be the other one I'd throw in there. If it crashes on day two because of what he does on day one, then I think that might constrain him. I don't think anything else is going to constrain him, including arguments from Josh Lipsky or Matt Goodman, or from his people around him, or even Congress. So I think that's the point I wanted to make before, is I do think this is such an important issue for President Trump that I think he's going to dam the torpedoes and move ahead. I sort of err on the IEPA side of this debate. I think he's going to do something big and strong from day one. If there are those consequences, he might find a way to pull back, but I'm sort of, my instinct is that, but don't hold me to that.
We'll see. So I took you on a tangent, but let me say on a
Trump, yeah, this Trump Truth Social post that just came out today while we were at lunch,
yep,
that President Trump is creating a new IRS, but it's called External Revenue Service, so ERS, and that will be concerning tariffs and raise revenue from the external, not just from American citizens, to the better of our economy.
That, I have to dig into that policy proposal, but I will say I don't know how efficient it is to create a new agency of government. I thought the we will see. So, but let me answer the industrial policy question.
Yeah, please.
I will quote here your colleague at CFR, Brad Setzer, who has said, and I think it's the great line on this, if you don't have an industrial policy, you are importing China's industrial policy.
Well said.
And I think that is really a way to think about these issues, and it goes back to what I said at the beginning. Both Democrats and Republicans have recognized we have to change the way we do business, how the government interacts with the private sector, and what industries we support here at home. Semiconductors, just one example of that, a sea change of what you would have seen 10 years ago, what we realized during the pandemic, the supply chain shocks, what we realized were critical, both to our economy and our national security. So the difference between Trump and Biden here will be the industries that are supported and the way they're supported. So will the Inflation Reduction Act continue? The money will be there. It will be called something different. It won't go as much to green energy and transition as it was going to go to in the Biden administration. But the idea of supporting industries that this incoming administration think are important for economic and national security, and therefore terming what we would describe as an industrial policy, do continue. It just looks different. You know, industrial policy used to be a dirty word. We used to associate it with the Soviets and five-year plans, and that's how we thought about industrial policy. But it's industrial policy with a capitalist flavor. It's industrial policy that still spurs the private sector investment, but it does have government involved in a sense of saying what is a national security priority. And I think you'll see that in the Trump administration.
I think we'll see less regulation. They're going to roll back regulations. The permitting is going to be shortened. I think that there will be less delay, denial by delay, where so many, you know, of our agencies just slow walk permitting, so that projects can't be completed or can't, you know, We have less manufacturing. We're losing tens of thousands of manufacturing jobs, I think, every month right now, every time they report. But the Nippon Steel deal, that's been in the news lately. Do you think that President Trump will reverse President Biden's decision to deny the Nippon Steel deal?
Yeah, it's really interesting. If you'd asked me that question 2 weeks ago, I would have sort of, are you kidding? Of course not. Trump has made very clear that he opposed the deal too. And, you know, Biden has taken this responsibility for him, so he doesn't have to worry about it. But the more you think about it, the more you think maybe he'll reverse it, because for three reasons, maybe. One, because the same politics that I think caused President Biden to delay his decision before the election, which was that in Pennsylvania, there are probably more people who support this deal than oppose it, especially in U.S. Steel itself.
I'm from Pennsylvania. I can tell you there's a lot of support in Pennsylvania.
So the politics of this are a little more complicated than meet the eye. You know, secondly, it's consistent with the Trump sort of make America great again, reinvesting in the United States. If a Japanese company is able to come in and keep a good American company alive and keep that capacity and those jobs, you know, that's broadly consistent with Trump's overall approach. And then thirdly, and I know this sounds a little superficial, but it's something that I think has truth in it, which is because it was Biden's decision, he reverses it because it's the opposite of what his predecessor did. I mean, I think that was 75% of why President Trump in the first term reversed TPP because it was an Obama initiative, not so much because it was, I'm being a little
suspicious. I disagree with you.
Well, I mean, obviously there were other forces behind it. There were other forces behind it, but I think that does play into President Trump's decision making.
I don't think as much as President Biden's decision. You know, I don't think he makes decisions just to spite someone. I think he really makes decisions to put the American people first. And so I do think he's.
Do you think President Trump?
President Trump. Yeah, okay. Yeah, I do. So I'll respectfully disagree with
okay.
you. But Josh, you know, we have the over-manufacturing, overcapacity in China. We've got the strain on the global markets. What do you think about advanced manufacturing? What are we going to do, the green technologies? There's a lot of tension around this. How do you see this playing out?
Well, this is what is going to define the trade wars, if we get into them, which I think we will in one way, shape, or form, of the next 4 years and the next decade. And let's just talk about what we mean when we say China's manufacturing overcapacity, because we just throw it out there and everyone says, oh yeah, that's a problem. What are we talking about?
I just want to correct myself. It's made in China 2025.
Made in 2025.
Yes,
yeah, that's China's, you know, not just on, that's technology and everything about Xi's ambition that he's mapped out over the past decade. But China has something like $1 trillion trade surplus right now, 10% of the size of their entire economy. This is unseen in modern global economics. Even the US, when we ran a trade surplus, and this was after World War I, when Europe was decimated, 5 or 6% kind of trade surplus. So we have just not seen anything like the scale of what China is producing on the global stage. And at the same time, they have weakening domestic demand. Their citizens can't consume the products because there's not enough economic demand internally. So where are the products going to go? They're going to come here, and they're going to go to Europe, and they're going to go all over the world. And you're only starting to see it in the data. And EVs are just a part of it. It's only one piece of it. And we lived through the first China trade shock, and we are potentially coming into the next China trade shock. The difference this time around is that, one, we've woken up to it because we lived through it the first time, so we're more prepared. And two, we're not alone. This is why you see the Europeans introducing tariffs on EVs. This is why you see the Brazilians introducing tariffs on Chinese EVs. So we will not be alone in combating the next China trade shock. The question will be, can the Trump administration work with allies in a coordinated approach? But when we talk about Chinese manufacturing overcapacity, it's a big economic jargony world. But what we're talking about is the next China trade shock and the issue that could define the trade wars of the next decade.
Well, Matt, do you see China and the U.S. being able to cooperate in trade? How do you see that going forward under the Trump administration?
Yeah, I mean, first, again, I agree with Josh. This is a real concern, and, you know, it can get a little sort of complicated, but it is fundamentally a huge challenge for us in economic terms and, I think, ultimately national security. And so I think that is really at the heart of the China problem, certainly in our space. There may be, you know, Admiral Ruffin is I think, worried about other things about China, but in our space, I think this is central. Look, I think, first of all, as many people have said, we kind of have to find some way to work with China on some things. There are sort of global, transnational issues that affect all of us. Pandemics is an obvious one. You know, there are issues around nuclear proliferation and problems in different parts of the world that we have a shared concern about. So I think there's a lot that we have to talk about, and we have to find some kind of mechanism for doing that. I think trade is going to be a hard one. Probably not top of the list, other than, you know, trying to manage the tariffs that are likely coming. But certainly, there's going to have to be some conversation about how to manage that. And you know, to the extent, as Josh said in that helpful sort of breakdown of how to think about different types of tariffs, you know, to the extent they are a bargaining chip, I think that's going to be, you know, play right into the U.S.-China conversations, you know, fairly early on.
Yeah. So, Josh, how do you expect the Trump administration to use export controls to restrict sensitive technologies, exports? How about the investment screening? How from foreign influence? How do you see the Trump administration manage this
Yeah.
We saw Biden, we saw Trump 1.0.
You know, really it was the Trump administration the first time around that sort of started expanding the use of export controls, and we think of foreign direct product rule and Huawei and everything that happened in the first Trump administration, and you saw that continue in the Biden administration. Really, the growth of the use of export controls, and there's a balance here because Washington has been so enamored really since 9/11 with financial sanctions. That is really what scaled up post 9/11, and you've seen a recalibration in the past few years thinking that export controls and these other tools might be more effective given the nature of the global economy than financial sanctions. The problem with export controls, I think from a Trump administration perspective, is that they take time to bite. So financial sanctions, whatever they're weaknesses and ways to circumvent them, there's something you can hold out immediately and say, we debanked, we de-swifted, this company, this bank is offline now. Export controls, and we see this with Russia, countries will have a stockpile of a product. So when you stop the shipment, it does not happen overnight that you see the tangible results of those export controls. So I think there's going to be a tension here, a recognition that there has to be more investment in the Commerce Department, in their capabilities, in supply chains, how export controls work, more resources dedicated to it, but the natural instinct of all administrations, both Democratic and Republican, to show victories quickly will come into tension with the use of export controls.
So I have another question for you, and it's really about global finance. So we've got the global financial markets, cryptocurrency, blockchain, quantum computing. These are all reshaping global finance, and it's raising questions about regulation, innovation, security. How do you expect the Trump administration to prevent financial crime? It's a big deal, ensure economic stability. And what impact do you think this will have on the US dollar as the global reserve currency?
Oh, this is a big question.
This is your question.
Yeah, the US dollar is the global reserve currency. I will say this. I think this issue is higher on the Trump administration's agenda than it was the first time around, right? So we were not talking as much in 2017, 2018 about the future of the dollar as the global reserve currency. Trump is tweeting about it now. We saw this a few weeks ago. Now, I really think it's important here, I say this often, to separate out two components of the dollar. One is the macroeconomic role of the dollar, how we use the dollar in trade invoicing, how it's used cross-border. Basically, do countries want to use other currencies for exchange cross-border? The dollar is really not under any immediate or medium-term challenge on this front. I know this is probably against some of the prevailing winds in Washington. It's just not. You can't point to any other currency, be it euro, yen, pound, renminbi, and say, look how that can challenge the dollar. Where the dollar is being challenged is on the national security role of the dollar, how we use the dollar in sanctions enforcement in particular. And there, countries around the world are building what we describe at the Atlantic Council in our research as alternative financial plumbing. They're building new pipes in the global economy. That takes time and money. It took us 50 years to build the global financial network, which underpins the dollar right now. But once those pipes are built, the water turns on in the pipes, and that's the money. So we have to be very cognizant from the US, I think the Trump administration is, I think the Biden administration was, that there's workarounds being built to the dollar that don't threaten the dollar as a global reserve currency, but do threaten the dollar in the way we've used it for our national security purposes, really over the last 20 years in particular.
Thanks so much. So Matt, the US has been a leader in the global economy, shaping trade rules. We made them multilateral institutions, economic norms. How does the incoming Trump administration envision the future of leadership in the global economy? And can you talk about how you think they're going to approach this issue with the global economic challenges we face and our domestic priorities?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first thing to say as a preface is that, again, these are longer term trends in a sense. They're these institutions and rules and norms that we created, as you said, after World War II, and that, you know, provided huge benefits to us and to the rest of the world, had already been under strain. I mean, as far back as the 1970s, when, you know, for maybe sort of three reasons they've been under strain over time. One is that that they have not engendered the same support from the American people, so we haven't been in a position to go out and support these institutions financially and in other ways. You know, secondly, the trust in Washington running things like this has eroded, and that goes back to the 70s with Watergate and Vietnam and so forth. And third, the institutions themselves have not performed as intended in many ways, especially the World Trade Organization, which was, of course, created later, but on the foundations of what was done at Bretton Woods. And so I think these institutions and this multilateral approach in our space has been under strain for some time. But, you know, certainly it seems that President-elect Trump, and certainly from his first term experience, is less enamored of this sort of multilateral system generally, and it bleeds into other domains as well, but certainly in the economic realm. He seems to be more interested in bilateral, maybe some mini-lateral or plurilateral arrangements, like I think the Quad probably survives for a number of reasons. Maybe some of the trilateral arrangements, but I think the G7, other sort of plurilateral arrangements, I think are going to be more difficult. So, and certainly the multilateral institutions. But again, he didn't pull us out of the WTO or the WHO or other or the IMF or other institutions in his first term. And
he pulled us out of the WHO in his first term.
Did I say the WHO? Sorry, I meant to say the WTO yeah. only. Yes, yeah. right. But some of these big economic institutions he kept us in, and so you know we'll see whether he does that in a second term.
Yeah. Well, I have a question for both of you, but I'd like to ask you first, Matt. So the U.S. has played this pivotal role in institutions like the World Bank, IMF. What role do you see these institutions playing in advancing U.S. foreign policy, economic interests going forward? How will the WTO fit in the broader framework? What reforms do you think are necessary to make them fit to purpose? Thinking about China, thinking about Belt and Road.
Okay, well, I wanted to say a word about Belt and Road, so I'll say something at the end on that. But let me take the WTO and I'll let Josh do the IMF and World Bank, which he's more conversant in. You know, I think the WTO is, you know, is deeply troubled. It's not really performing on any of its core mandates, you know, enforcing existing rules, settling disputes, negotiating new rules, even providing transparency on the trading system, which, you know, was one of its core functions. It's really failing at all of those things. And that's, you know, for a lot of reasons. It's partly overreach by the institutions and the bureaucrats and people appointed to those organizations. It's partly disruption from other players. Like obviously China and Russia, but South Africa and Turkey and India have been disruptive forces in the WTO, and we've been disruptive in the WTO. You know, partly because of frustration. Again, going back before the first Trump administration, actually my former and current boss Mike Froman was the guy who actually denied one of the judges on the dispute, the arbitration council at the WTO, ultimately let one go through, but turned down the first one. So there's been concern on both sides of the aisle about the WTO for a long time, but you know we know that the Trump and certainly under Robert Lighthizer in the first term there was a very different view, sort of philosophically, about the deal that we made when we went into that institution in particular, that we were willing to sort of tie our hands a little bit with these rules if everybody else had their hands tied as well. That was kind of the deal, and I think Lighthizer thought that was a raw deal, and I would expect that Jameson Greer and others involved in the second Trump term trade policy will see it a similar way.
So on the IMF and the World Bank, I think it's important to say at the beginning, these are two of the most functional of the multilateral institutions. Compare the IMF and the World Bank to the UN. Both of the institutions have problems. I'm not pretending they don't. But the IMF and the World Bank send money out the door every day to countries that need it. They use it. You can question where the money's going. You can question how the money's been spent. But the institutions both function. And that is not true of every international institution, be them diplomatic like the UN or economic like the WTO. So we should value that. And what those institutions are afraid of, and I can say this as someone who used to work at the IMF, is falling into the political dysfunction that you see at the UN, mm-hmm. that the system essentially breaks down and they can no longer function. So that's one side of what's happening at the IMF and the World Bank. Then the question is what the Trump administration should do about it. We should really value the resources we have as the largest shareholder in these institutions, because I promise you China understands the value of these institutions. China independently is the largest bilateral lender in the world as a country. So they are lending more than any other country in the world bilaterally, but they are also big players at the IMF and the World Bank. So they get the best of both worlds. They're lending bilaterally, advancing their foreign policy and national security and economic goals, but they're they're also leveraging the influence they have at the international financial institutions. We are the largest shareholders of the international financial institutions and underuse that privilege because we don't spend enough time. So my advice to the Trump administration, and we've talked to the transition team about it, and I know they understand these issues well from the first time around, is don't lump all international bureaucracies together. There are different levels of international bureaucracy. IMF and World Bank are valuable ones that you can use. You have to invest in them. And I think that's what this administration will do. That might ruffle some feathers within these institutions, but I think that's the right way to approach it.
I agree.
Wonderful. So looking forward, let's forecast 10 years from now. How do you see this incoming Trump administration, the decisions on trade policy, shape our competitiveness and our geostrategic position in the next decade?
Yeah, well, it's a big question. 10 years is a long time, but it is worth going through the exercise of thinking about that time difference because we're putting down, you know, putting down some things that are going to have that kind of long-term effect. I think that the investments that both the Trump and Biden administrations, and I would expect in a second Trump administration, are making in American capability, from infrastructure to semiconductors, or as Josh said, it may be different critical sectors, but we are making those investments. I expect that to continue, and that will provide a needed foundation for our, not only our economic competitiveness, but for our national security, that will have that sort of time, over that time period, some beneficial effect. Some of it, you know, is going to take that long to really play out. I am concerned, and again, this is not a partisan concern because I think it's both parties have, or both of the last two presidents have pursued a very protectionist approach to trade. And I worry that is not going to enhance our economic competitiveness or the strength of the foundations of our economy. If those are used as a tactical measure, a bargaining tool, or to protect infant industries, or for real national security reasons, you know, there are arguments for using tariffs. But I think this fundamental trend towards protectionism is worrisome to me in terms of building a solid economic foundation that I think 10 years from now we could regret. And I'm sort of hopeful we will get back sort of gravitationally to something that is more like a modified version of the old system, of a more open trade investment regime with caveats.
You mean with a level playing field? Where
yes, and I mean that's obviously,
the same,
I mean,
as our,
and
tariffs,
meanwhile,
and not
that's
taking advantage of,
meanwhile,
them.
That's going on. I would say there are reasons for using tariffs, and that's one of them, is that, you know, China and others are not playing fair, and we do need tariffs. But I still make my point that I think the general trend towards closing our economy is not good for us for
not
the long
China,
term.
Not just China, even our friends,
yeah,
right?
That's right.
Right.
Josh?
The first thing I think to say about the next decade is that the forces that will define it are beyond the policies of any administration, be they the Trump administration, the Biden administration. They involve AI and quantum and issues that will develop on their own regardless of what any particular administration does. And this is what will shape the future of productivity growth in countries, their ability to create jobs, their ability to be at the forefront of technological innovation. And I really think the defining challenge for the U.S. is whether we sort of lean into this new reality of economic and national security fusion, embrace it, and define it with Western and capitalist ideals, and do so in partnership with allies in Europe, or if we try to go back to the way things were 10 years ago, 15 years ago, and try to revert, because that era is over. We are in a new era, and the question for this administration is what policies shape that era. You can't control it. The forces are bigger than anything you can control, but you can shape it. And if you do so in partnership with like-minded nations, then you can be successful. So I think those are the challenges over the next decade.
Plus demographics, which is another challenge.
Yes, 100% agree.
Growth is just about number of people and how much each person can produce, essentially. And so if our demographics are not favorable, as they're not for most advanced countries, that's a really important point about structural.
Yeah. Well, a lot of advanced economies, Japan, and that is weighs on growth and it weighs on the economic and national security of those countries. It does.
Yes. Yeah. So the question of how to balance U.S. protectionist tendencies with the need to maintain global economic leadership, I'll just say, under the Trump administration, since I worked in the 1.0, is that it's America first, but not America alone.
Yeah.
But how do you both see that?
Well, I think again, I think both you saw this in the Trump and Biden administration. I think there were impulses in both directions, frankly. And I think you know, with Biden, I was just talking to a reporter today, still about Nippon Steel. There's still interest in that. That, you know, I think that really highlights the Biden tension between his impulse to work with allies and partners to do a lot of things in the world. With his, you know, protectionist instincts, if you want to call it that, because that was really, you know, the basis for that decision, as opposed to real national security concerns, in my opinion. And so this tension exists, I think, on both sides of the aisle, and maybe it's a deeper American concern, but I think in the end, and I think Admiral Ruff had said it very eloquently, I think in the end we need our partners, we need alliances, we need to work with others. These challenges, while the United States has a lot of capabilities and we have a lot of advantages, we can't solve most of these global problems by ourselves. We need help.
Yeah, I think that on the America first versus America alone point, time will tell in Trump 2.0. And I think what's important to remember is that other countries have their own domestic and international national security and economic priorities. So we have come from a place, and Trump has been reelected from a place of deep feeling of where there has been unfairness in the system, really going back decades. But these countries have their own issues that have generated their domestic politics and their priorities. And I think if the Trump administration recognizes that, then they can do what they do, which is make deals. But if it comes from a place of this is only what America needs, then it will not be received well by allies around the world. And that's why time will tell whether this works or not. There was a story in the Wall Street Journal this week, and I thought it was fascinating. It said that it's under consideration in the next Trump administration because they're very worried about retaliatory tariffs. Because, okay, maybe tariffs aren't inflationary, but clearly retaliatory tit-for-tat tariffs would be. And the idea floated by incoming Trump administration members was, well, we could basically say the security guarantee is up for question if you implement retaliatory tariffs. And that's where I think you cross a dangerous bridge and start calling in the question of deterrence. So the question will be not only what we prioritize as a country, but our understanding of what our allies prioritize, and if we can do that, then this administration can be successful, and if not.
Well, thank you, Matt and Josh, for your expert input, and I just wanted to open up to the audience for questions for Matt and Josh, and if you do have a question, just raise your hand, and a member of the team will bring a microphone to you, and then just please state your name and your affiliation, your institute that you're with.
There is a woman up
there. And there's someone in the very back row.
Thank you very much. Is this working? Thank you very much for a fascinating conversation. I have a question about cryptocurrency, the role of cryptocurrency in the international financial markets. Is it, other than a means of laundering money, is it a challenge to the dollar? Is the primacy of the dollar? I'm not really sure how it works, but it's looming on the future of our financial system, I think.
Sure, I'm happy to take that. It is looming on the future of our financial system. It's growing in importance every year. Stable coins, which are dollar-pegged cryptocurrencies, that's why they're called stable coins, 99% of them are pegged to the dollar, are growing in volume every year, with hundreds of millions of dollars of transactions globally. It's not an immediate threat to the dollar because it still is such a small scale compared to how we use dollars around the world. What is a threat, I believe, is the technology that is being used and how other countries could weaponize that technology to create faster systems of transmission of money outside the dollar. And that's a little bit what I was talking about earlier, the national security role of the dollar. So it's not Bitcoin and these cryptocurrencies, sometimes used for very, you know, legal purposes, sometimes used for illicit purposes, as you pointed out. What it really is countries finding faster and cheaper ways to work around the dollar. By the way, de-dollarization, the interest in getting around the dollar is nothing new. This goes back decades. This goes back to the history of sanctions. You can go back to Cuba in the 1960s. But what's happening right now is that financial technology is meeting the interest in de-dollarization in a way that it never has before. And so if it costs me to send money between Iran and Russia, if I have to go through 17 correspondent banks and it takes a lot of money to avoid making sure Treasury sees that transaction, if it costs me a little less because of financial technology now, I'm going to do that as an actor in Iran or Russia. And that's really the challenge here. So it doesn't threaten the dollar as we use it every day, but the technology is important and countries around the world are adopting it. And I just want to say, our approach in the US should not be just to wag a finger at that. It's very instinctual to just say, China bad, Russia bad, Iran bad, don't do that, stay on the dollar. Instead, we should build the best, most innovative technologies based around the dollar. Because if we do that, no country in the world can afford to be outside the dollar, euro, pound, and yen, that system. So we should be offering countries carrots, not just sticks. That's why they wanted to be part of the US-led system in the first place. It wasn't just because we threatened them, it's because they saw the benefits of being part of the system. And that will ensure the dollar remains the global reserve currency going forward.
Can I say something which isn't about cryptocurrency? Josh is the real expert on that, but I do want to foot stomp the last part of what he was saying about offers and really what Admiral Ruff had said as well in about the concerns about Belt and Road. I mean, you know, we're not going to stop China doing Belt and Road and digitizing Belt and Road and all the other things they're doing in the world. We've got to find something better to offer that competes with China and gives other countries a reason to follow us. So I think I meant to make that broader point. I think that's fundamental to economic security as well. We have to be in the game of offering the best of what the U.S. has to offer, which I think there's a strong demand signal for still a lot of things that the United States offers, including in the economic and commercial realm. And so I think we need to focus, keep our eye on that ball, even while we're trying to protect ourselves, which is also important.
Fully agree.
Thank you. My name is Adrian Zuckerman. I'm former U.S. ambassador to Romania in the first administration. I have a question for you, Josh. In Africa, for example, I don't think you can find a dollar-denominated transaction if you search from east to west, north to south. To me, I'd like to believe what you're saying, but I'm a little troubled by that. And I think that from what I understand, and I'm not an expert on this, it's spreading to South America and a lot of other places. I also see it developing in Europe. So I'm not quite sure I understand your optimism why the dollar's not endangered here.
Yeah, and I don't want to be, you know, overly Pollyannish about the dollar, but when we look at the data, we look at how countries hold their reserves, which is a signal of where countries feel like the safest asset can be. And that has only marginally moved away from the dollar over the past 20 years. And it hasn't moved into China, and it hasn't moved into adversarial nations. It's moved in Canadian dollars and Australian dollars and what we would describe as geopolitically aligned countries. So that's where some of the optimism comes from, because there's no real alternative right now to challenge the dollar at global scale. But we shouldn't sit on our laurels and be happy about that. Because if our position is only defensive, well, no one can compete with us and there's no challengers, eventually someone will. And that's what I was trying to say before. We should innovate from a position of strength. There's no doubt what you're saying is correct. On a retail basis within countries, there is far more non-dollar payments going on. We just don't see that having an effect on the dollar at a macro global scale. It doesn't mean it couldn't over time, which is why we should be bringing the best technologies to bear on this. I see this all the time. We do work on central bank digital currencies, stable coins. Countries want US leadership. They're begging for it. They're hungry for it. We often don't come to the table with anything. And then they turn to China and other countries and say, fine, if you're the only one coming to the table. We heard this earlier in the conversation about ports. It's true in the digital realm as well. So just because we don't see it in the data yet doesn't mean we shouldn't be worried about it. But I also don't think it's time to panic. There's nothing that can rival the dollar. We just have to get back in the game.
Was there a question up here, the lady in the pink suit? Did you have a question?
Thank you very much, Tamana Salakudin with USIP. Really appreciate your comments thinking about harnessing economics and trade for either protectionism at home or maybe punitive measures against other countries. But you're talking about competing with China. So connecting to the first intervention we heard, how can we offer countries, whether in Asia, the Middle East, or Africa, which many of them are hedging, and they're economically, as you said, receiving, they're receiving the infrastructure or the, you know, digital stack from China. How do you see economics and trade actually serving any of these countries? I mean, what thought is behind actually competing for those? In all of the countries we work in at USIP, they're like, fine, China is bad, but what do you have to offer instead, right? And often we have nothing. And a second part to that question, you talk about the Bretton Woods post-World War II infrastructure. Most of the countries across Asia and Africa say these systems are not working for them, right? They're all at the IMF. They're all at the World Bank post-COVID, and they really aren't working for them. And so they are looking for alternatives. Yes, they have lots of bilateral loans with China, but the vast majority of their loans are actually to the Paris Club. So they don't see much difference between the two sides. So where is our strategy to actually compete economically? Thank you.
I go first, and then Josh. So your question, the first question, validated my point that we need to be offering something that is credible to partners. And that's hard for us for a lot of reasons. It's easier for China to offer large amounts of money, although they wasted a lot of money, and some of that got them some blowback and hasn't worked as well as they originally intended. But we can't wait for them to fail. We have to offer something. And I think the answer lies somewhere, and I think, again, Admiral Ruff had alluded to this, in our private capabilities. You know, we have amazing, you know, companies with amazing products and services and after service and things that people really understand are good. It may be a little more expensive, it may take a little more time, but we do have some great offering there. And then our financial position. I mean, China said originally said it was going to spend $1 trillion on Belt and Road. Well, whoop-de-doo. We have $100 trillion in insurance monies, pension monies, you know, hedge funds, other financial assets that if we could find a way to deploy a small portion of that into some of these solutions in these countries. And that's what both the Trump and Biden administration have tried to do through various, and I've forgotten even the acronyms of some of their initiatives. Certainly it's behind the Biden administration's Partnership for Global Infrastructure Investment of trying to crowd in private money into infrastructure and other investments in the global south. And you know, it's hard though, and it does require the government to put some skin in the game, money and other forms of risk mitigation to help the private sector really get that risk return balance to be at a level where they feel, okay, now we can go in and support. I think that's the key. We have to find a way to mobilize that money.
Yeah, and I would just say there's a huge opportunity coming up for the U.S. because the Trump administration will host the G20 in 2026. I think this is an incredible opportunity to define in real policy terms some of the issues we're talking about today. Economic statecraft, geoeconomics, what we bring to the rest of the world, not just advanced economies, but emerging markets. So the fact that it'll be here in the U.S. is actually incredibly important coming next year. On the Brentwood system, you're 100% right. Countries say this all over the world. I lived this when I was at the IMF. I heard it firsthand. There's no difference between the Paris Club and there's what China's doing to us. I do think over the past 18 months, some countries have rethought that because of the experience with Zambia and other countries in the G20. Now we're getting very wonky in IMF world, but the G20 debt sustainability framework. Because it turns out China found out what every lender in the world finds out. It's easy to lend the money. It's hard to get it back. China's now starting to be on the back end. They've been lending money for a decade. Now they're in the place of having to collect it. And guess what? They found out what the IMF and the Paris Club and everyone else found out. Some countries can't repay on time, and China has not been very flexible about that situation, and countries who are on the receiving end of that have noticed it. So you're right that countries have said, what's the difference? Why shouldn't I take this money? They have started to have an awakening given some of the tensions and the inability to renegotiate over the past 18 months or 2 years, and we have to take advantage of that from a US perspective. We have to say, look, you might not like the IMF and the Paris Club, and that's fair, and we have to reform internally about our processes, but at least we're always willing to come to the table. We are willing to negotiate. We do not want to see you go into debt default. So for all the problems we have, at least we're not saying no and forcing your country into a default. We don't push the issue enough. We let these things kind of play out in the international sphere. We're doing some, they're doing some, because we're so scared of breaking what we think works. But to your point, maybe it doesn't work, and we shouldn't be afraid of breaking it if it needs to be broken.
I see two ladies here toward the front.
Thank you. Nancy Zirkin, Vice Chair of
USIP. Thank you. Nancy Zirkin, Vice Chair of USIP. I heard Matt say that that he thinks, and I don't disagree, that what many economists have said, that when Trump comes in, he is going to go for big tariffs right from the get-go. And we've heard all the predictions and everything else. What would a moderate approach be if he chose that way under the sections you actually cited?
Yeah, well, I mean, just by using those tools like Section 301, Section 232, that would be a little more moderate by itself, because those authorities require publication of the proposed tariffs and public comment and, you know, various forms of implementation that takes quite a long time. So you could see him on day one signing things saying, I'm going to put 301 tariffs or 232 tariffs in place, and it will take quite a while for that to play out. Obviously, he can moderate the rates, and not, as he's already done, yeah, from 60% on China to 10% in more recent statements. And he can also calibrate and say, we're going to do it only on critical things and not on sort of ordinary things that consumers really still want to get cheaply. So there are a variety of ways in which that could be parsed out. I think Donald Trump himself wants to go big on this issue, so that's what I'm sort of watching for.
My only please.
I was just going to say, what would the effect on the economy be with a moderate approach?
Yeah, I think that on the moderate approach, if it really happens, there's a good argument that it would not be really destabilizing to the economy and not be significantly inflationary. If it really is moderate, if these are phased in, well signaled, as long as there's not tit-for-tat retaliatory tariffs, which are going to be pretty hard to prevent, because one thing we haven't talked about that's different than the last time around, other countries are much more prepared than they were for Donald Trump the first time. They understand his way of doing business, they understand his economic toolkit, and they've been preparing for the last, not just 4 years, but 6 or 7 years at this point, their own economic statecraft. China's not the only one. We saw their own export controls on critical minerals, gallium. This is something you never would have seen. So in the first act, they're actually not inflationary and would not harm the US economy, and maybe you'd see some benefits. But if they spiral, that's really where you see the problem. I think a little disagreement I have with Matt here is maybe the difference between going big and being perceived as going big. So I can very much see an announcement on Monday, Inauguration Day, Tuesday, the next day, Donald Trump tariffs China at 20% or 25%. But do those tariffs really go into effect on Monday, January 20th? Or then, does the Treasury Department say to China, we'd like to reopen negotiations on the phase one trade deal that we negotiated with you in the first administration? So I think we all are gonna have to do a job of parsing what is said and versus when it is implemented, because those could be two very different things, because the tariffs that are announced next week might only be a means to bring China back to the negotiating table, not necessarily intended to be implemented as announced.
Well, I just want to just kind of dispute with you a little bit. So you mentioned gallium, that China just said, you know, we're not going to send you gallium. We need the critical minerals. They control the majority of the critical minerals that we need for our defense industry, for our cell phones. But as a matter of fact, during the pandemic, China stated publicly, maybe if you don't do what we want you to do, we're not going to send you the precursors for all your medications.
Yes, remember
you need.
This.
And they did say, well, maybe if we don't like what you're doing, if you don't do what we want you to do, we're not going to send you the critical minerals. And it was a blanket critical minerals. So they have used threats via trade for years. Yes. This was in the end of the Trump administration, the beginning of the Biden administration. So it's a while ago.
Yeah.
But so they have been those actors, and they do it all over the world.
100%.
And to much weaker nations. So I think that, whatever we need to do to get this trade situation right and to reduce the trade deficit that we have with China is essential. Do we have time for one more question? All right, this gentle lady.
My name is Zainab Usman. I'm the director of the Africa Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Very fascinating discussion. Two quick questions. One on de-dollarization. Just to add some color to the Honorable Ambassador's comment about no dollar transactions happening in Africa. actually a key challenge for a lot of African countries right now is that the dollar is the dominant currency for their central bank reserves, for their cross-border trade, and also for sovereign loans. And a number of African countries, I mean, including others in the Middle East and so on, are trying to see how they can work around that, not necessarily because they hate America, but because it's very expensive to borrow in the dollar. Interest rate payments and principal repayments are very, very high. Cross-border transactions are very difficult, and you know, a whole range of other factors. So my question to the panel is, how do you see the incoming administration responding to prospects of de-dollarization? Because there are initiatives right now underway to try to see how to use local currencies mm-hmm. for these, you know, for whether it's reserves or cross-border transactions or sovereign borrowing. And then the second one is with respect to trade. What do you think is the direction of travel for the incoming administration with respect to preferential trade programs like the African Growth and Opportunity Act, which is set to expire in September of this year, and then the generalized system of preferences, which already expired in 2020. When you combine both AGOA and GSP, you have close to two-thirds of countries around the world that are beneficiaries of those programs. And if across-the-board tariffs are implemented that affect these countries, the US is essentially going to lock itself out of trading across significant product lines with these countries. So any thoughts on trade and developing countries and these preferential trade programs would be helpful. Yeah. Thank you.
Great. I'll take the first on de-dollarization, then turn to Matt on trade. And thank you for the question. So what you're alluding to, BRICS countries and other countries really trying to finance more in local currencies because of the issue you identified, not wanting to get away from dollars, but how difficult and expensive it can be to access dollars, and this is driving a lot of the interest in finding alternatives. So what will the Trump administration do about that? It's an open question, but I think there's a couple routes they can go down. One thing I think you will see is the unleashing of dollar-backed stablecoins in the global economy. Now, this has two sides of it, both a risk side and an opportunity side. But one thing dollar-backed stablecoins provide is easier access to dollars. Now, you can dispute whether they're dollars or not, but at least in terms of their value, they're much more accessible, and they are valued at exactly a dollar one for one if you trust the company that's issuing it and that they're pegged to it and would not depeg. But you're going to see a much more crypto-friendly administration. There's no doubt about that. And you're going to see a deregulation environment. And that means there's going to be these dollar-backed stable coins flooding all over the world. There's already demand for them. We see this across the world. And so I think you see this as one outlet for the demand for dollars, not dollars issued by the central bank or traditional commercial bank, but digital currencies, stable coins, what we would sometimes describe as digital dollars, but they're not issued by the central bank. The other question is how we make it cheaper to access dollars. And this gets into fundamental questions for the Treasury Department, the issuance of treasuries, how we function in the global economy. And if I will say, if there's someone who can address this issue, I think the incoming Treasury, Scott Bessent, is well placed to do it. This is a person who has been a currency trader. This is a person who famously broke the Bank of Japan, as he is known for doing. So he understands global finance. He understands how money moves around the world. That doesn't mean he's going to be able to tackle that issue, but I think it's more salient on this administration's agenda, recognizing there's a problem around the world, which you're identifying.
Yeah, on those trade preference systems, I mean, first of all, there is an alphabet soup of different related initiatives that are going to be needing reauthorization, including AGOA and GSP, which you've spelled out, so I don't have to, the Development Finance Corporation, the Export-Import Bank, the Millennium Challenge Corporation, PEPFAR, the President's Emergency Fund for AIDS Relief, I think are all coming up for reauthorization in the next few years. And so all of that should be watched to see how the administration proceeds. I mean, there's reason to believe the Trump administration, like they helped stand up the Development Finance Corporation. They were pretty supportive of using the Exim Bank. I think those preference programs, they're not that expensive. Great colleague in the trade world, Ed Gresser, you know, showed that the amount of trade covered by the generalized system of preferences globally is about $29 billion worth of US imports is covered by that program. By comparison, we did $80 billion of trade with Ireland last year. So it's not huge amounts, and the cost is obviously a fraction of that. So I think there are people in Congress who believe in these programs. They are important tools of American statecraft and our offerings in the world. And I'm both hopeful and expecting some progress in getting those things reauthorized.
In fact, I worked with Ex-Im Bank and Development Finance Corporation on the Greenland issue when I was the U.S. ambassador to the Kingdom of Denmark. So they are tools, but I think we need to expand them in order to really have real tools in our tool belt. I welcome you all to take a break and join us for refreshments outside the auditorium on the on Leland. And thank you very much to Josh and Matt for your expertise and sharing with us your great knowledge about these subjects. And thank you for being here, and I look forward to seeing you on the outside.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this event. If you'd like to listen to more events or explore our other podcasts, visit usip.org/podcasts.